I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition. As we heard from Phyllis Haynes in last week's show, so much of our problems can be solved if we master the art of listening. Now, most of us go right to our ears when we think of listening, but my next guest will tell you that you should listen to your whole body to find important answers. You should listen to what it is trying to tell you, that your body contains vast amounts of information we simply miss because we are distracted with other things. I met Martin Wheeler during a martial arts seminar he led in Phoenix, Arizona back in the summer of 2019. Now, in karate, there are numerous types of kicks and punches and stances and forms to learn and memorize. Just like in business, we have many other things to memorize, such as strategic planning, running a meeting, reading a balance sheet, mentoring an employee. Martin wasn't there to teach us martial arts, but rather a way of being in order to achieve optimal performance while performing your art. So think of it this way. Computers have software programs like Microsoft PowerPoint, Excel, Photoshop, and operating systems that enable those programs to run, Microsoft Windows or Apple's Mac OS. Martin teaches how to run your operating system effectively so your software runs better. Those who are fellow martial artists will hear the philosophy and vision behind the exercises Martin takes groups through. For the non-martial artist and the business person wanting to learn how to listen to their intuition by trusting their gut, Martin provides wonderful advice on how to tap into this superpower housed in our bodies. I started by asking Martin to explain the framework he works within, a framework called Systema.
I guess the easiest way to describe it on a sort of visual context for somebody who's never seen it, it's kind of like Tai Chi on steroids. It's a kind of a soft martial art, essentially, if you could think of it that way, with pretty well sort of boundless opportunities in it. It's good for stand-up fighting, ground fighting, multiple attacks, weapons fighting. And that's just really the fighting aspect of it. It was something that probably was an older Russian martial art that was adopted by the Russian Special Forces at some point during the Soviet times, and really sort of taken by some of the elite espionage infiltration type unit guys as something that was not seen by the West. The West wouldn't have known what it is. So obviously they kept it pretty well under wraps. But essentially it's a martial art without techniques or forms. It's a martial art that basically springs from recognizing your intuitive self and allowing yourself to work from there.
And so any student in martial art then could study Systema and in a sense be better at those techniques that they learned in that particular form.
I think they will probably be better at their martial art as a whole, it's rather than just specifically at the techniques. I mean, I think it's based in principles of relaxation and structure. So obviously anything that relaxes you more when you're fighting and controls your structure in a better way and your breathing techniques is going to help in anything that you do. But I think one of the nice things about Systema is because it's not really bounded by a technique structure, it gives you a way of looking at kind of universal structure of your martial art rather than specifically the pieces of it.
So one of the things that I've always been fascinated about in doing work in karate, Kempo karate with Mr. Sky Gonzalez that you know well, is that I've always been curious and just fascinated by kind of the gestalt of it. That how I feel on the mat translates into how I perform. I remember years ago when I was just a lad, I was playing tennis with my dad, and he introduced me to a book called The Inner Game of Tennis, and it always gave me this sense that how my mental state was seemed to translate in how well my backhand was being able to be executed. And I guess I wonder if you could speak to that, this how you bring yourself into something, whether it be Sistema or parenting or running a business, how the inner self sort of relates to the outer performance.
Yeah, great question. Well, I would say the paradigm shift with something like Sistema really for this is that, yes, I think your mental state definitely, if you meditate before a game of tennis, I'm sure it helps your game of tennis in some form or another. But I think the shift with something like Sistema is actually how you perform. Sistema helps you to read the book or live the life outside of the martial art as much as anything. So it's kind of a reverse process almost, where the Sistema itself is the process by which you're actually aiding your life rather than your life is aiding the game. But I think anything where you allow your inner state to start to have some sort of access into whatever it is that your speciality is, or your speciality could be being the caretaker for the family, as much as it could be, being an operator in a military situation or something, or anything really. I think it allows you to have a much more broad focus on what you're doing, as rather than sort of like this sort of very specific sort of set of train tracks that you can get on as to what your purpose is.
Right. As we were getting ready for this podcast, you and I were talking about a trip that you just came back from over in Hong Kong. And I shared with you that I was there during the first student uprisings. And you just came back, and obviously it's a very different world. Can you draw any correlations between this sort of geopolitical issue that's taking place in this really difficult situation down in Hong Kong, and that sort of connection back to the self and being present and that inner being? Is there any kind of lessons learned that that we can make some sort of corollaries between your work and what's sometimes going on out in the world?
I mean, yes, definitely. There's always something you can correlate to it. I mean, there's some fairly terrifying ones, I think, on the sense of what your inner being really is. I mean, Hong Kong is basically being leaned on by China. I mean, I believe they have a full takeover rights in 2047.
Right.
And I think the British agreement with Hong Kong ended in 1997.
97, correct.
Yeah. And so obviously, it seems like China's kind of like starting to put its tentacles into sort of seeing how they can interact with Hong Kong and basically, turn it into a Chinese province as opposed to almost at the moment, it's almost like an archipelago, even though it's connected,
Right.
I think it's very difficult for it. I mean, Hong Kong is a very westernized Chinese country.
Yeah.
I don't think westernized countries are terribly introspective as far as what there's never really been until this point in time, I don't think, much reason to look at the internal state and how it affects your external state. I don't think that's been the thrust of Western idealism as far as, especially in sort of, colonial. I mean, the reason the Brits took over Hong Kong in the first place is because they wanted to sell opium to China. So
right. Right.
I don't think there was a lot of philanthropic sort of,
right,
state stuff going on there. I would say that, against the insurmountable pressure that something like China will exert on Hong Kong and the people there, I mean, the only place they're going to have to really escape to is either out of Hong Kong or inside themselves.
Yeah.
Once something like a totalitarian rule of something like China takes a hold of could you imagine if China took a hold of Hawaii? How would the people's lives there change?
Right.
Which is essentially the same type of thing. I was talking to some of the guys that live in China, And there's something that they, I mean, I kind of knew about it before, but I didn't really know how it would be implemented, but they have a social credit system, which basically means that your actions as a citizen will either be a positive for you or a negative. And if it's a negative, it's literally sort of like taking you out of the system in a sense. Like one of the guys came to the seminar that I taught, a friend of his, he's been living in China for 7 or 8 years. He has a wife and a couple of kids in one of the suburbs of one of the fairly major cities. I mean, but they're all pretty big cities out there, you know, it's a massive population.
Yeah, huge.
Center. And he said basically most people kind of keep to themselves because they don't really want to interact overly with others because, you know, A, they're not quite sure who they're talking to and where that information will go. But, you know, speaking openly in the street about these, the things that we're talking about right now is just a no-no there. It just wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But they have this social credit system. Like, so, okay, so one of his friends got into a bit of a scuffle, nothing major, just a, you know, some little Saturday night thing. And now through the social credit system, he has been banned from using transport for a year. So he can't get in a taxi, can't get on a train, can't get on a plane, can't get on a bus. I doubt he would be able to use any tollways or anything like that. I mean, could you imagine how that would affect your life?
Yeah, it's amazing.
For a year, if you were basically isolated to your home, and even within your home, I mean, getting onto the internet or something like that, you have a, you know, pretty restrictive access to current affairs or world actions and, you know, what's going on in the world. So, you know, do I think there's a place for internal work? I mean, there is for everything, for everybody, for any type of social pressure. But when that social pressure is something you literally couldn't step outside of yourself for, I think it would probably be essential.
Understood. So when you do your work, do you hear students or do they make the connection between what they do with you on the mat and how that translates into what they do at work?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, within months, I get... No, normally what happens, I mean, I live in Los Angeles, and the best barometer for stress that you have here is probably traffic, because it's the one, you know, mean value that everyone has to deal with. I know that I'm getting through to a student if when they turn, without prompting, they'll turn up and basically look at me and say, you know, I didn't get angry driving here today. And I think, ah, okay, the pennies are starting to drop.
So if we kind of narrow this down and being more, we just sort of described it as being more internal. We're not as stressed. We can go to traffic jams and not come into work feeling the effects of that. How does this connect to you regarding that inner knowing, that intuitive self? Do you feel that your work, in addition to all the other things that might go on, makes people more intuitive?
I don't know if it makes you more intuitive. I think it probably gives you more access to your intuition.
Okay.
I believe my nature is probably a highly intuitive type nature. I mean, I lack in other areas, but intuition never seemed to be a problem for me. And I think that it most likely has given me more access as to what that intuitive state's advantages are, because I explore them more. Or I have a ways of exploring them more that I probably didn't before.
So given that you said that you are fairly intuitive, and I get your point that maybe it's not about becoming more intuitive, but accessing what you already have.
Maybe that does make you more intuitive as well. I might be, you know, splitting hairs.
Yeah, sure. So what's your tips? What would you suggest to somebody if they said, you know, this is fascinating. I love what Martin said. It sounds like he's doing some really great work. I may not be able to go to one of his seminars, although I'd love to. And I do want to make sure that by the time we finish this little chat, we find out what you're doing so people can connect to you if they desire to. What would your formula be or your suggestions be if somebody said, I really need to kind of get back to that inner knowing? Coming from your art, your perspective, your talents, how would you instruct them?
The first thing to do is get in touch with yourself. I mean, systema means the system. But the meaning of it really is to know yourself. And the training methodologies are very much designed to use the art as almost a microscope on your internal state. So intuition is a very, it's a very complex subject. It has a lot of different meanings to a lot of different people as well. I mean, it's not one specific. If you were to ask 10 people what intuition means, I'm sure they'd probably give you 10 different answers from their own points of view. And if they were to give you 3 different states of intuition, they'd probably be struggling by the third one, because it's one of those things where you kind of trick yourself into thinking you understand what it means, but until you really question yourself, right? So sort of honing down, I think the first thing to do is, if you wanted to use these techniques to develop your intuition, I think you first would need to develop your personal target, if you like, as to what intuition meant to you. And then, I mean, obviously, once you have a target point, then you can start to reverse engineer the ways that you need to get there. But on a general scale, I think the best things to do is to start to understand yourself from the things that trigger your intuition. Close your eyes and listen and hear what you're hearing, and then maybe stuff your ears and see what you're seeing, and seeing if those two things are affecting each other, or where the information is really coming from for you, and how it's affecting you. What is it triggering when you get information? Because intuition is probably the secondary stage of information gathering, really. So sort of like cleaning up the pathways by which you get information is probably the first thing. So for example, if your information base that you want to make more intuitive was touch, which would be very useful for a martial artist, then you should touch people and not just hit them, right? You know, because your martial art is kind of based around the fact that you're trying to defend yourself, probably. You know, most people, you know, but I mean, I've been teaching martial arts for a long time now. And one of the questions I often ask people is, when they come to me, is, well, why have you come to me? You know, what is it you'd like to achieve? And what is it you're trying to know or understand? Or, and I get a, you know, a fairly good standard box set of answers that which everyone feels that they really believe is what it is that they're there for. Some people say, you know, well, I always wanted to do martial arts, or I want to be fitter, or I want to be more confident, or I want to be less something else, or more this. But really, a lot of these things really boil down to very sort of essential drivers in us, which are, you know, fear and protection of your family. But they're these all kind of, as much as they're courageous, they're also sort of fear-based, you know. Every time, I mean, if you have something courageous, it's because there's a fear of something in the first place.
You mentioned that why people come and work with you, and you have all these different answers. Do you feel that in a person's intention plays a role in them in some way, shape, or form being intuitive, that it helps guide the focus?
Yeah, definitely.
I was thinking about the example that I can give, a very visceral one, is the workshop that I was with you. I was watching you demonstrate a punch. You know, it looked like not much from the perspective of the audience. It just looked like you were doing a really small little fist punch into somebody. And the difference between one particular punch and another was night and day. And then I asked you the question, so I can't see any difference here. What are you doing? And he goes, well, you're going to have to experience it, which was my downfall right there. And yeah, the difference between one punch and the other punch was just absolutely huge. And it, from all other perspectives, it looked like he's not doing anything different. And all the thing that I could think of, and you've got to tell me whether I'm wrong, maybe there's some sort of minor technique that I just could not see with my eyes. But the only thing I could come up with was he had a different intention. He was somehow thinking through my body versus to my body. And that particular intention sent energy past your fist into my stomach, and I could feel it throughout my entire being. Am I on the right track?
I think so. I mean, obviously everything is, you know, everything lives in nuance, right? I mean,
right.
You know, if I was to ask a violinist why, how they play one string or another, they'd say, well, I pluck it, you know, but, you know, but the obvious difference is if they did it in one way or another, to them would be huge, and it would be the intention of what it is that they were trying to make it sound like.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of how you could almost look at a body and psyche and psychic system is that, you know, what note are you trying to play with this system? Hmm. And the way that you pluck the string is in the nuance of your intention, basically. So, well, let's put it down to sort of two basic or fundamental ways of looking at it. You can hit somebody with blunt force trauma, right? Boxing probably would be a great, or karate would be a tremendous, you know, you learn how to punch bricks in half and boards in half and things like that, you know, and you're conditioning your hand to be able to do that, and your wrist and your elbow, and, you know, and you're sort of creating a tension-based catapult system with your body with which to do the old intention, which was, you know, one punch, one kill type. I mean, I did karate and things, but I did Kempo actually for a long time, right. 18 years. And I can't think of a better way of delivering a punch than a boxing or a karate punch, essentially. I mean, if you're trying to hit somebody with as much force as possible in a contained area, which would either break or damage them or incapacitate them in some way. You're literally sort of turning your body into a physics example. Hmm. I guess if you were to really explore it, you're not really giving yourself much room to maneuver internally with that. It's pretty well an external process that you're teaching yourself how to fire and trigger in a certain way. Now, does it work? Of course it works. I mean, you know, every, you know, champion boxer that I can think of, or decent boxer, or decent karate fighter or UFC fighter uses exactly this method. And it's, you know, 100% effective if it's done 100% correctly.
But I think what you're saying is that techniques has its limits.
Well, techniques have a very specific result, which is limited, yes, in some ways. Yes, absolutely.
And that sort of the layer on top of that technique, I'm using the word, maybe it's the wrong one, but some sort of intentionality.
Yes, definitely. And well, I think it leaves out a certain intentionality because there's a very narrow band of what your intention can be with it. You know?
Right.
But if you have a wider sort of, if you have broadband intention, then you want to have a sort of broadband ability to deliver that type of intention, basically.
Right.
So for me, if I think about it on a scale of, you know, well, what am I really dealing with here? I mean, it's me, and let's just say it's just one other opponent for now, okay? You know, we're both being controlled by a very complex consciousness system. But essentially, that consciousness system, as complex as it is and how long it's been, you know, the millions of years it's taken to evolve to this, you know, wonderful jewel that's in our behind our eyes, right? To switch it off is fairly simple. I mean, you hit somebody in the back of the head with a piece of wood, you know?
Right.
And it shuts down every system that you have. And possibly permanently. But is there another, but to deliver that means that they, if they are observing you in some way, that you go through a specific set of tension-based actions, which their conscious system is very attuned to being aware of, because we're all sort of driven by these same, you know, sort of existence factors for a long time, that recognize specific types of tension and intention together that could hurt us or damage us in some way. So if you take out the necessary markers that somebody would use to recognize that, then you'll start to slip into another type of, let's call it striking for now, where you're essentially learning how to touch somebody so that you redirect what their conscious system does in a way that's very different to blunt force trauma.
Hmm.
So if I'm using my consciousness to look out and I get hit very hard, then I might shut down. Like if I get hit in the liver or something like that, that's a perfect example, right? Where you're basically shocking the liver into saying, oh, you know, damn, our liver is shutting down. Even though, you know, it's just a shock of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
We better lie down and shut down all the systems so we don't have to, you know, pump blood at 6 feet up in the air. And, you know, if we do hit the ground, you know, we don't want to do it from a passing out position standing up where the head could hit the ground. So we better put this body on the ground and start to get into some kind of recovery. Now, that's very different to having a different type of intention that you're maneuvering the conscious system in a sense to stop looking out and to start looking inside. And once it does that, that means that even if I'm protecting myself and looking outside, I still can some way protect myself from the next thing coming in. If I can get hit in a way or touched in a way that makes my mind start to look inside, then it's not looking outside anymore. And that means that the person on the outside, you can't even recognize anymore because you don't, your consciousness is simply not looking out anymore. So it's kind of more to do with that.
And I'm not sure this connects or not, but I remember something that was pretty profound that I experienced with you and I saw others experience was, and I love the philosophy of it. There was the hit, you know, the stress, I've been hit. And then there's the reaction to it. And that the pain is often more in the reaction than in the hit itself. And that I know that we did a lot of work on releasing the energy from the strike and through breathing. Mm-hmm. And I've thought several times about, okay, so we go to work and we don't get hit, but we do get hit emotionally. There, we do have things that happen to us that are considered to be stress to the system. But the real stress is the response to the stress, right? It's the holding it and the locking of the body around that particular stress that then keeps it alive and then internalized for a long period of time. And I just thought that was one of the jewels that you shared during that weekend was around being aware of how you hold stress past the moment that it was first introduced.
Yeah. Well, I think we've developed that talent very well. over time, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the things that kind of, for the wonders of having the ability to build a rocket ship that can go to Mars, I mean, comes with a lot of other things that turn against you as well as for you.
Right.
My friend was telling me about a book called, you know, Why Zebras Don't Get Cancer or something.
Right.
And, you know, essentially they're saying that, you know, the zebras got two prime directives, you know, eat and procreate and you know, basically live some sort of level of comfort. And then the tiger comes or the lion, right? And then they think, oh, crap, you know, lion. And they get very, you know, they shoot up into these very high sort of stress states and they run and run and run. And then, you know, if they survive the encounter, they don't need a therapist afterwards.
Right.
10 years, you know, for what happened, because that would be, if they couldn't exist in their world after that period, they'd just be dead anyway.
Right.
So they're very good at releasing not just the external problem, but the internal reaction.
Right.
And, now, is that because they don't really have much ability to sort of predict the future? And so that this could, maybe our problem is that we predict the future too well. So we, once we get a stress like that, we start to, you know, multiply the problem, what it could be, into a future state.
And some of that self-awareness you were talking about before becomes our, you know, our nemesis, because then we so overanalyze the thing that just happened, which then probably keeps it to us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you can sort of amplify this with a punch if it's done the right way, by hitting somebody in a state where the actual, there's no damage done by the strike, but you've kind of like excited their stress system in a way that they multiply what the problem is inside themselves, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 30 times, until it becomes overwhelming. And if you can start to, you know, cut that off at the pass, it never becomes kind of the flood of information that your brain then has to deal with.
Well, Martin, I'm afraid we're going to have to close it out here because we're at the top of our hour, and I know you've got stuff to do, and as do I, but I just really appreciate your time on this and just think that you just are a brilliant master at what you do. If people wanted to connect with you, upcoming books or seminars or workshops, how would they do that?
Sure. Yeah, I've got a book. Hopefully, it should be finished this by the summer. Seminars, definitely. Go to WheelerSystema.com. So that's WheelerSystema.com. And my seminars are all listed there. I'm all over the world. Anybody's welcome to come. Please come and enjoy. You'll find it very relaxing in a certain way.
At certain times, it's very relaxing. Other times, it may not be. Yeah. No, it was one of the best. One of the best physical workshops I've ever been involved in. I think that you just do incredible work. And you're a philosopher. I think what you did so well was not just walk us through this and let us demonstrate it and let us feel it, but it also, you were able to connect the dots, what was going on neurologically, what was going on physiologically, emotionally, and draw connections to what was going on with people in the other world outside of that day. I just thought it was just tremendous. So thank you so much for your time on this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, great. Thank you. I will be back in Phoenix as well, teaching in October, November.
I heard. I'll be there.
I look forward to that.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Dean. Great.
You bet.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.